Media critic Jay Rosen, already well-known in journalism circles, gained even more attention last December with a blog post entitled Winter is Coming, his summation of press prospects ahead of a Trump presidency. What does he think now?
There is an organized campaign to discredit the mainstream press in this country. And obviously, now it is being led from the top. The president himself conducts daily seminars in why you should hate the media.
Rosen, a professor at NYU, was in Illinois earlier this week. Coming up, our conversation with him. Plus, we talk with the Urbana children's book author who just wrote a new nonfiction book for middle grade readers about the racehorse, Alexandra.
It's a fine line to not anthropomorphize, but on the other hand, from her body language, you can understand that she really knows that she's top-notch, and she's not going to apologize for it.
It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ever since last year's election result, which was totally missed by pretty much everyone in the media, journalists all over the country have done a lot of soul searching. This comes as the Trump administration has taken an unprecedented approach to the press. Here's how media critic Jay Rosen describes it.
This is a very important fact to understand. There is an organized campaign to discredit the mainstream press in this country. And it has three levels to it. Obviously, now it is being led from the top. The president himself, the most powerful person in the country, conducts daily seminars in why you should hate the media. It also comes from the bottom in an army of online trolls and activists who shout down news stories they don't like, attack journalists who cross them in one way or another, and encourage other people in a sort of frenzy of mistrust. There's thousands of people like this online. I hear from them all the time. And then in the middle, between the two, there are mediating institutions like Talk Radio and Matt Drudge and Daily Caller and Breitbart that connect the top and the bottom. So when I say an organized campaign to discredit the mainstream media, that's what I mean.
Rosen, a professor at New York University, has been analyzing the role of journalism in American life for more than 30 years. I spoke to him in Urbana on Wednesday night in front of a live audience at a talk organized by the Unit for Criticism and Interpretive Theory at the University of Illinois. Here it is. I wanted to just start by asking you about this whole winter is coming in journalism, and the idea of the informal norms that we have in our society that give the press, that sort of give the press freedom to operate, and ask you where you're seeing those norms break down the most right now.
Well, it's important to say they still exist. It's not like they're gone completely. And that letter from Mexican journalists was touching, but it's important to add that we don't have mass shootings of journalists in this country. We don't have journalists being dragged off to jail for reporting the truth. There's no prior restraint. Prior restraint is when the government prevents you from publishing your story or going on the radio and telling the truth. We don't have that yet. And so on all of those ways, the press is still free to do what it does. And it's important to say that because the situation could be a lot worse. So the erosion of norms that I'm talking about are, and this is what's so startling, is it's starting from the top. It's Sean Spicer's first briefing, which he used to berate the press, tell it, the assembled reporters, how terrible they were, and project a lie.
Did that take you by surprise?
Yeah, a little bit.
Was it the tone or just the fact that he came out of the gate with that?
The fact that this was the first communication, that it was so blatant, that it was about something easily disproved, like not even a close call.
A number.
Mm-hmm. And that he did it and then walked off. That was the most shocking thing. He wouldn't even engage in a dialogue about it, which is the whole purpose of the briefing room in the first place. And so that, just the fact that you could do that, that you would do that, that you would violate professionalism and practice right out of the gate, you know, in an unprecedented display of denialism was shocking. So it's that, it's diluting the briefing room with all kinds of news sites that probably don't belong there, although some of them do. It's the refusal to answer simple questions. And it's the breakdown of the whole system of White House communications. For example, this week on ABC This Week with Martha Raddatz, the deputy press secretary, who happens to be Mike Huckabee's daughter, Sarah Huckabee, deputy press secretary of the White House, goes on TV to answer questions, and Martha Raddatz asks her, well, what sort of proof does the president have that Barack Obama tapped his phone? And he said, and she says, I can't speak for the president. Let the radio audience know I just slapped my forehead.
And the look of despair you had on your face. Yeah, because, I'll just add that.
Because what possible purpose could there be to talking with Sarah Huckabee if she doesn't represent and can't speak to what the president is thinking? So the whole idea of a spokesperson, the whole idea of a White House communications office has, for the purposes of that statement by Trump, evaporated. Because when reporters called and said, well, what is the president talking about and what is this based on? The White House communications office said, nothing. Right? And so when the White House is treating the statements of the president as inexplicable, you definitely have the erosion of some norms.
You also said something in your talk. You know, you said that President Trump doesn't care whether or not what he says is true.
Yeah.
And you use the example of the news conference where the reporter actually read to him the Electoral College because I'm not going to say the numbers correctly, but he said, this is how many votes I got. And the reporter actually had his phone and said, actually, no, this is how many Barack Obama got. And then this is how many. In that moment when he sort of dismisses everything and he says, well, someone gave me the incorrect information. How do you think journalists should be? Well, I'm going to start with, I want to have two questions, right? How do you think audiences should handle that? But let me start with first, how do you think journalists should handle that?
I think something like that has to alert them that this is different. This is a different phenomena than what they are used to reporting on. And if it is a different phenomena, then it may call for different routines and different assumptions. So I'm not saying here's how to cover that. I don't necessarily know that. I'm just saying that that is so far out of the norm that it raises a question of novelty. Are we dealing with something that's historically novel? And I would say that at least in the information sphere, in this area that you asked about, which is he doesn't care whether what he says is true, that's a radical rupture with past practice. And there's a reason for it. I wrote about this recently in my blog. In fact, the most recent piece of my blog is about this. Since the Cold War, since Americans and everybody in the world knew that the United States president could blow up the world and had the power to do that, the White House has been very concerned to show that the president is a very careful person. The president is informed. The president is in contact with the network at all times. The president is never alone. The president has the best intelligence in the world. The president has people letting him know what's going on in every corner of the world. And there's practical reasons for that, but there's also a psychological reason for that. When you can blow up the world, you're supposed to be like kind of in control of things. You know, that's a good idea. Trump doesn't participate in that at all. He has a different idea, which is sort of like, if you can blow up the world, it's great if nobody can rely on you, if you're unpredictable, if you might be a little crazy, because then they'll be afraid of you. You know, maybe that's the idea. I don't know. But
I was going to say, is that what you think it is?
I don't think he's thought it out, you know? But if there is a counter strategy to this normal strategy, it has something to do with that. It's like, and I think it might be what he has in mind, because he's known for for saying that about himself in business. You know,
right, they, I like to keep nobody
yeah,
knows
I like to
I'm
keep them
from.
Guessing, mm-hmm. right? That's why I'm such a great negotiator, because nobody knows what I'm going to pull out of my hat, right? But with nuclear weapons, you know, that's a different story. But the point I'm trying to make is that there's a reason why we have norms. They're not just the cake of custom, you know? There's a reason we have those norms. And Trump doesn't seem to care about that.
I want to talk about something else you mentioned that is related to this, which is this whole, you use this term verification in reverse.
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit? Which is, this is a method that you describe that President Trump actually launched his political career on.
Right. So when I said in my talk tonight that somehow reality had become a weaker force in politics, I was partly referring to this. So verification is something journalists are very concerned with. That's sort of their bread and butter. Verification is, did that really happen? Verification is taking something that might be true or something that somebody said and nailing it down with facts, with evidence, getting the data, getting the records, getting interviews, finding out, were you there? What actually happened, right? That's like 90%
yeah,
of what journalists
do sure.
is verification. And that's why we need them, because right? they are, in a sense, the specialists in verification. Verification in reverse is taking something that's already been nailed down and introducing doubt about it. And when you introduce doubt about it, a lot of energy is released by that. Controversy, furor, denial, news coverage. And then you can try and power a political movement with that energy. So this has become more common. And Trump launched his political career behind an act of verification in reverse, which was birtherism. He took a fact that had been as nailed down as you can get. There's the document. You can't actually get more verified than that. Where's the birth certificate? Right here. As far as verification goes, that's the end of the road. He took this fact, introduced doubt about it. That releases a lot of energy. You try to harness the energy for your candidacy. And that was the launch of Donald Trump, verification in reverse.
So I want to ask you a little bit about the news media, how we do our job, how I do my job. You can ask me questions too, obviously. I forgot to say that. You're free to ask me any questions you want to ask.
I have a couple.
I figured you did.
Yeah.
I want to ask about the fact that, you know, when you're talking about, and I agree with you, by the way, about political reporting and sort of the horse race and how that happens. But I want to ask you about that whole strategy of political reporting. How much of that is something that really happens more on coasts? Or do you think that's sort of diffused through all of journalism now that everyone just, you do think so?
Yeah, I think for the most part, and there might be exceptions in individual markets, but for the most part, the people who are drawn into political reporting in Iowa, you know, are trying to do Washington Post journalism in Iowa. And not all, but for the most part, there's a very good reason, which is they would love to be hired by the Washington Post, which one of them last year was.
Mm-hmm.
The lead political reporter for the Des Moines Register is now a Washington Post reporter. For the most part, insider journalism that focuses on the maneuverings of the political class and that takes this sort of savvy tone towards everything is the style. Now, I'm sure there are local institutions, you know, reporters who've become sort of fixtures in their community, who are dedicated to that community, who probably do it different, because you find those people. But anybody who's on the career path, who wants to, like, be ambitious, they're going to do Washington Post journalism in Wichita, like I said, for a very rational reason. They don't necessarily think that's what they're doing, but that's what they're doing.
And then when you mention sort of the whole idea of strategists and the round table and the, you know, how does this play with this voter kind of thing, I'm curious about that because I feel like that happens now in a cable news cycle. I feel like that, and I actually question the relevance of cable news at this point in American society. And I'm curious your thoughts on that because I wonder how many people are actually watching that. And I think it's a generational thing. Certainly, you know, I would think my parents are an example of they have cable news on all day.
Yeah.
And I think there is a certain sector of American society that does that. And they do, there's maybe, you know, I think they watch two or three different channels. But do you think that, I just wonder about the relevance of that in society anymore, and if you see that waning. Because I wonder how much this election was sort of, in a way, the nail in the coffin for cable news networks. Or we'll look back on this as sort of...
I see what you mean. Now, CNN did make $1 billion in 2016. So it's funny when people say, no one watches CNN. Well, they made $1 billion, so somebody must have been watching them. But yes, in a way, the inadequacy of the cable news view of the world was shown very clearly by the events of 2016. But I don't think you can say it's just a cable news thing for this reason. When you watch Meet the Press, Face the Nation, which are produced by CBS and NBC, it's the same style. If you watch the PBS NewsHour, which is public, mm-hmm. It's not fundamentally different. Judy Woodruff went from CNN to the NewsHour seamlessly. She didn't have to change her style to accommodate the fact that she was now in public television. She just did the same kind of journalism that she did for CNN, but maybe she had more time, or she could be a little bit quieter, in fomenting conflict or something like that. So I don't think it's confined to cable news. But
no, maybe I should put television news, network news in there.
But I think you're right that kind of news doesn't speak to whole sectors of the population. And you can't necessarily base your ideas about what journalism is from watching too much cable news. There's definitely a danger in doing that.
That's media critic and NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen in a conversation I had with him in front of a live audience at the University of Illinois in Urbana earlier this week. We'll have more with Jay Rosen after this short break. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been hearing about the future of facts, reality, and journalism in the Trump administration from NYU professor and media critic Jay Rosen. I sat down with him in front of a live audience at the University of Illinois earlier this week. We took some questions from the audience. Here's some of them.
Hi, my name's Steffi, and I have so many questions because, as you pointed out in your presentation, there are so many complex problems happening at once, but I'll try and stick to one. So you touched on how the tech industry is kind of taking over the relationship between people seeking information and the people providing it.
Right.
Do you think that there's a way that we as journalists and members of the media community can work with the tech industry? I mean, right now, in a lot of ways, they seem very unwilling when, like, Mark Zuckerberg saying, oh, no, we're not, a news organization. But we do see some efforts, like, trying to work with Snopes more and things like that. Do you think those are a step in the right direction?
Yeah. And both Google and Facebook, not Apple News so far, are slowly starting to recognize that they have some responsibility here. Google more so than Facebook. But there's several things that are in the way. One is, this is a contest between the very strong and the very weak. You have to keep that in mind. It's not like these are equals talking. News is a speck in Facebook's universe. It's a tiny part. And if news went away tomorrow, Facebook would still be a highly profitable and powerful company. There is one way in which journalists have leverage, and that is that for Google, definitely, for Facebook a little bit, if the information that people call up when they go to Google, when they go to Facebook, becomes known as more likely to be false than true, or as likely to be false as true, that's actually a problem for Google. It's a problem. They don't want their search results to be efficient in delivering you crap information about the Holocaust. That's not good, right? And Facebook is starting to realize that if people go to Facebook for news and a healthy portion of what the news is false, that's a problem for them. What they're not willing to do is begin to undertake that editing judgment role themselves. That's why when Facebook said, okay, we hear you about fake news, we're going to start putting little warning stickers on truly false stories and let you know that this has been fact-checked, which is good practice. They themselves did not want to take any responsibility for fact-checking. So what they did was they contracted with third-party fact-checkers like factcheck.org and PolitiFact, and they're using the judgments made by other people to put these little stickers on things, right? Which is okay, but it shows you how freaked they are about taking on any editorial role. Finally, one more thing on this. When they set this system up using like 6 or 7 major fact-checkers, they talked to me about it beforehand as they did with other journalists just to sort of get a sense of what people's reactions are going to be, you know, so they kind of like gave me a preview of it. And when they gave me the preview, I said, okay, this, you know, this seems reasonable. I think it's a good step. But I just want you to know that within an hour of you announcing this, the right wing is going to denounce it because it's going to say that every fact-checking agency that you selected to help you is liberal. I just want you to understand that that's going to happen. They go, well, they think, well, we're neutral, you know, we don't think that's going to be a problem. You know, we don't have any agenda here. I said, it doesn't matter whether you have an agenda. I'm just telling you what's going to happen. The day they announced it, it didn't take an hour. It took 20 minutes. Within 20 minutes, every fact-checking agency that Facebook contracted with was denounced as the liberal media, not fact-checking at all. And this, and so, you know, because that's culture war, right? Culture war doesn't care what's true. They care about an opportunity to extend the war to another battlefield. So Facebook ultimately needs social legitimacy, because if it's not seen as a trustworthy platform, then two things could happen that would cramp its style. One is regulation, government regulation, and the other is people won't trust it, so they won't give it their life, right? Like their photos and their birthdays and their weddings. And so that fact is where journalism can enter and say, hey, you can't ignore this because it could affect your whole future.
I will just add one thing to that. And I say this all the time, so I feel like I have a platform to say this, and I feel like I need to remind everyone of this. Facebook is a business. It's based on the information they give you. And everyone forgets that. And everyone turns everything over to Facebook and thinks it's free and doesn't realize the price that they pay when they do that. So I agree with Jay about Facebook is learning that it needs to be better, even simply from an advertising perspective, right? Because if you go into your advertising preferences, you can go in and you can see what Facebook thinks about you. It can tell you what it thinks your political views are. It tells you what you think your ethnicity is. And it had all of mine wrong. So I thought it was really interesting when I went in and I looked at my settings that based on the news that I guess where I was clicking and what I was consuming, Facebook was wrong. So my only hope is that because they're a business, they'll figure that out. But everyone needs to realize that they're not content creators. They refuse the title of a media company, and they are there to make money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that everyone forgets.
And they have no editorial culture.
Exactly.
It's an engineering culture. Very different thing.
Right.
I'm David. Professor, thanks for being here. Appreciate you coming to talk to us. And you mentioned that eventually Trump or the White House is going to have to deal with this question of Russia or reckon with it. Why do you think that is the case? I mean, what, based on everything that you talked about, you know, what makes you confident that he'll ever have to answer for that?
I said Congress, not Trump. Congress will eventually have to deal with it, just because the weight of the evidence, the power of democratic norms, which are still in effect, the work of the committees, the relationship that the committees have with the intelligence community, which is very important for them, to them. I think Congress is much more susceptible to the pressure of accumulating fact than Trump is. Trump and the White House will try and will succeed for months now, for maybe for years,
in just saying there's nothing there and stonewalling and attacking those who uncover new evidence and escalating their tactics. I mean, they're prepared to do almost anything to keep this story from expanding. So I don't have any faith that they're going to be forced to reckon with it, but Congress might.
Hi, my name's Kaya, and I have a question kind of about bright spots, I guess. I'm an educator, and I'm wondering in any of this if there's any hope for fostering more critical consumption of these, you know, texts and how we can, and you know, encourage everybody. And do journalists have a role in that, too, about educating their audiences?
Well, when the news matters to people, then it's really easy for them to get them to read it critically. So when people care, you can get them to look at how are reports about this thing that you care about being constructed, and who's an authority, and who's considered an expert, and what's the storyline, what are the repeat storylines. And people who have obsessions, people who have passions they can't drop, they are ripe for media literacy because they're very sensitive to differences in tone and placement and emphasis and so forth. So that could be good. An atmosphere of emergency is good for education. When people are upset about what might happen, that's when they need information. So, and also there's a very deep, intimate connection between participation and information. And when people are participating in something, whether it's street protests or sports or a music scene, that's when they know they need information. So there's a profound connection between journalism and participation, you know? So anything where people are drawn in as participants as opposed to just watching the news or being a spectator is another opportunity for education.
I would say just anecdotally, for us on the show, we have very much noticed in the past couple of months an uptick in audience and interest and engagement. We've seen that at the station in terms of donations, of people being more engaged and wanting to give money to public radio stations, especially as people have heard conversations about sort of the ongoing conversation about CP, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and whether or not it will be funded. And I've been surprised how much in the past, even just month, we've heard from our audience just how much they appreciate the show. So for us, that's always gratifying, because normally people just, you know, the rule is normally you just hear people complaining about something. So, and a lot of times it's just a tweet or something like that, but we've seen a lot of that. That's helpful.
Hello, my name is Alex. Thank you very much for your talk. Along that, the lines of that last comment, as an educator who has worked also in journalism, I often find, you know, we're encouraging our students to interpret things differently, things that for a very long time they might have taken as fact or something as a longstanding truth. So I wonder if there might, your thoughts on, is there a need to maybe be to hedge a bit, to be a little bit, maybe a little bit more hesitant in using that kind of language of this is a fact, this isn't a fact, in that it becomes so polemical. For instance, if I'm trying to reach out to that 30% that would automatically discount maybe what I'm saying as an expert, there's, you know, obviously it's not about the facts, it's about something maybe more deep-seated of a kind of resentment, of, you know, of elitism. I'm just wondering if that kind of just debate on language, as far as, is it about trying to find that bridge, not using the language of fact, this is a fact, this is not a fact, but maybe rather talking more in terms of building a kind of sense of community of, oh, well, this is, I like the word evidence that you used. I'm just wondering if it gets so loaded when you use that word, I think.
Yeah. I think it's a good point. I mean, there is something about fact and fact check and you have your facts wrong that is a little, not a little, can be a lot inflammatory, and it puts people in a defensive posture. So I think there's something to that. Evidence is is a little bit more neutral. Also, I'm a big fan of using this construction in journalism. Here's what we know and what we don't know. And what we don't know can be a very powerful thing. Finally, let me tell you a little story from like 20 years ago in my career, way before the culture war was as bad as it is now. Foundation President David Matthews told me the story that he was in a meeting in Kentucky that was about gay marriage, which at the time was a very explosive issue. And it was an auditorium full of people who were deeply divided on the subject of gay marriage, with a lot of LGBT people who, for whom this was like a foundational issue of identity and equal rights, and another group of people who were, for whom it was equally foundational, like, in their ideas of marriage. And the minister who was running the meeting could see it sort of spiraling out of control. I'm sure you've been in conversations like that. And he says, wait a minute, hold on a second. Show of hands. How many people think this question of gay marriage is a profoundly moral issue? Everybody raises their hand. And he says, let's start there. Right. So even though it doesn't erase any differences, finding that moment where you can get everybody to raise their hand, maybe we should start with that instead of the facts that everybody is arguing about. You see what I mean? Like there's something in that idea of let's start with what we can all agree on. Now, it used to be we thought we start with a common world of facts and then we disagree on what to do about them. Right? That was then. Now, like, we don't have the luxury of that anymore. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you're entitled to your own opinion. You're not entitled to your own facts. Well, sorry, but that was 1980, right? In 2016, people feel very entitled to their own facts. So maybe we have to start in a different place. So I'm with you on that.
I think for us, it's also, this is going to be a very public radio answer, but I think that stories are really important because I think it's just about sharing individual stories, because I do think ultimately, I do very much believe in people sharing their own voice and just being able to connect with someone on a human level, which is, I know based on lots of conversations I've had with Scott about political communication and how people can come together, that interaction is one of the few things that actually helps change people, is person-to-person interaction. And so I think that as much as we could do that, that's also a very helpful thing, as much as journalists can facilitate that. When we think about the power of individual stories or images and making people realize, hey, actually, maybe we do have something in common, is kind of helpful too. But that's kind of a, maybe, I don't know, is that too typical of a journalism answer for 2017?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, it is a very interesting part of this phenomenon that when you bring the people who are so divided together in the same room and they talk to each other as human beings, the divisions at the national level don't really appear as much. So that's interesting. There's got to be a reason why in person it doesn't have the same force that it does in the voting booth or on cable television or in public debate.
That's a good place to end, I think, and it's 7 o'clock. So thank you so much. Thanks for being here, Jay. Thanks for being here. That was NYU Professor Jay Rosen. Stay tuned. The 21st continues after this short break. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A filly named Rachel Alexander had an unlikely path to 2009 Horse of the Year. Despite being labeled unsuitable as a champion racehorse, she overcame the odds, went on to break numerous records, and earned that title of Horse of the Year and show the world what it really means to run like a girl.
The horse is at the center of a new nonfiction book for middle grade readers. It's called Alexander the Great, the story of the record-breaking filly who ruled the racetrack. And I'm joined in studio now by its Urbana-based author, Deb Aronson. Deb, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla. It's great to be here.
So you write in this book, when this little horse, this foal was born, you never would have thought a few years later that she would capture the hearts and minds of lots of people, but especially lots of little girls and women across the country with her girl power. Is that what attracted you to this story?
Yes, absolutely. I am not a horse race fan generally, but I remember when Rachel was in the news and she had a very distinctive blaze, which makes her also makes her stand out in a crowd. And so I was really rooting for her, and that was exactly what appealed to me.
So you used the term blaze. I learned a lot of horse terms in this book, and fortunately it's great because it's a middle grade reading book. They're sort of like the bold words of blaze. That's like a facial marking a horse has on its, I guess, like, well, really on its face, right? All the way from its ears all the way down to its mouth, its nose.
Yes, it's basically on what I think of as her forehead, and then their stockings, which are what are down on the feet.
And those how did you learn all of these different horse terms? Because you spent a lot of time with the people who, lots of people will know the name Calvin Burrell, the very famous jockey who rode Rachel. I think even people who are not horse people or follow the Derby or other big races will know his name because he's so famous. You spoke with him and her owners, lots of people.
Yes, I have to give a shout out to her original trainer, Hal Wiggins, who sat with me in his living room for 2 full days, basically telling me about how thoroughbreds are trained and that kind of thing. And he was really the best resource. But like any writer, I did a lot of other research, too.
And what kind of research goes into writing a book, especially if you're writing this? Why did you pick, by the way, middle grade readers as the target for this?
I picked middle grade because in my own reading life, that was the age where books just really came to life for me. I always was an avid reader, but there was something about middle grade that those books that I read, particularly I remember a biography about Marie Curie, that just made me feel like I was part of that world and really, really resonated with me. So I like the idea of writing for other kids that might have that same experience.
And so what age would you say this is particularly designed for?
Well, it's kind of a vague thing, but and it depends, of course, on people's reading levels. But I would say something like 10 to 14. I also like to think that middle grade is a level of reading that actually most adults will also enjoy. So it's not a hard and fast.
So this is sort of like before YA or...
Before YA okay. And after picture book.
And so when you talk to lots of people to sort of understand the horse terminology, what other kind of research did you do into her story of this horse?
So, of course, I went online. I watched all of her races, which are all on video available. I read tons and tons of newspaper articles. And then really for me, interviewing the people that knew her and worked with her was the most important. In my regular day job, I write profiles anyway for other kinds of publications. And I love meeting people. I love hearing their stories. I feel like that's the kind of thing that brings a story like this to life. And so once Hal Wiggins met me and helped me, he also introduced me to all the other people that were so central to Rachel's life.
And so that's what this is. This is a story of this particular personality, which is this horse. And you have a line in the book that I really love, which is you say that horses have personalities too. What did you learn about Rachel's personality?
What I learned about Rachel is she is really a diva. She's a diva and she's an athlete. So she was not trying to be a crowd pleaser, but if people cheered, she just kind of was like, yes, I know, I'm a queen. Thank you very much. That is as my due. And it's a fine line to not anthropomorphize. But on the other hand, from her body language, you can understand that she really knows that she's top notch and she's not going to apologize for it. And on the other hand, if you go to visit her at Stone Street Farm where she's retired, she knows that people are coming to take her photograph and she will pose. That happened when I visited her.
So she posed for you.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of Rachel Alexander's accomplishments, before we get to sort of the story of how she got. Can you talk about some of the records that she broke, especially as a filly, as a female horse, because horse racing is an interesting sport where male and female animals can compete against each other, but it's not that common.
That's right, particularly in American thoroughbred racing. The first race that really put her on the map for sort of the general newspaper reader was the Kentucky Oaks, which is the race for fillies, only fillies, the day before
the Derby.
Kentucky Derby, mm-hmm. which everybody knows about. And Rachel destroyed the field of fillies. They were all the same age. They were all fillies. And she beat them by 20 lengths. They were practically not in the same field of view for the camera. So then the world set up and took notice. It was shortly after that that she got sold to a different owner because he really did want to see her compete against the boys. There's a long story there about the pros and cons. But after that, her biggest accomplishments were the next race, which was just 2 weeks later, the Preakness, which is the second race in the Triple Crown. And she not only raced against 12 horses that were all male, but she started from the outside gate, the 13th gate. Nobody had ever won the race from
the 13th gate. No horse had ever won that, right.
So that was a big thing. And I guess, and no filly had won that race in 85 years. So that's a pretty big deal.
And what I love about this is you also have the relationship with her to Calvin Burrell, because was he the first jockey to win the Triple Crown on three different horses? Was that, or the?
No, he did not that year win the, no.
He had won because what he had raced.
He had raced Mind That Bird. So the day after the Kentucky Eight Oaks, he raced Mind That Bird, which had a 50-1 odds to win the Derby. And he came an amazing come from behind. And he did
he
win
won
that.
The Derby. And so, then he won the Preakness racing Rachel
yes,
Alexandra.
Yes. But he didn't win Belmont.
Oh, he didn't win Belmont. Okay, no. Sorry. So that's not the no. Triple Crown there.
No,
right.
But I think what's really striking about that is that he did have a chance by winning on Mind That Bird. He could have stayed on Mind That Bird for the Preakness and gone for the Triple Crown. And to me, that was very, very striking that he chose to get off that horse in order to ride Rachel because he thought she was absolutely the most amazing horse he'd ever ridden.
And they really have this, he loved her. And I think my favorite part of this book is how even after she retires, she never forgets him. And when he comes back to visit her, which he still does, she recognizes him right away.
Yes, I think there aren't that many people that had that kind of relationship with her. And Calvin, as people who know him know, wears his heart on his sleeve. So he's just a big barrel of emotion. But he still was over the top in his affection for Rachel. I mean, he loves racing, obviously, but there's something about Rachel Alexandra that just captured his heart. He really loved her, loved her, loved her.
And what was it about this horse that captured everyone else's heart, too? Because you describe when she starts running races, how many people start wearing pink hats, how many little girls start. There's sort of all of these T-shirts that say run like a girl. And this becomes sort of a whole thing also of people really embracing her.
Yes. I don't know completely what appealed to other people. I think a big, big part of it was this storyline of a girl racing boys and beating them. There just are not that many storylines like that. And the other thing that appealed to me about Rachel Alexandra's story is the few other times where fillies have challenged male horses. In many times, they've tragically broken down and they've had to be euthanized at the track. And Rachel was really strong, and her legs never gave her trouble. That's, you know, the weak point on a racehorse. And I just love that she prevailed.
My guest is Deb Aronson. She's an Urbana-based author. She's the author of a new nonfiction book that's out for middle-grade readers. It's called Alexandra the Great, the story of the record-breaking filly who ruled the racetrack. One of the things that's really interesting about this is you talk about the gender, just sort of little, the history of the gender discrimination in horse racing and how her story fits into that, and how even when they tried to enter her into the Preakness, a lot of the male horse owners were really upset and they were trying to enter other horses in because they didn't want her to compete because she was a last minute entry.
Yeah, it's a complicated story in the sense that some fillies do have the physical attributes to race against male horses, but there's also this complicating factor of how expensive horse racing is if you are a trainer and an owner. And so there's a kind of, you don't want to risk hurting your horse, putting her maybe in a situation that is going to end up with her injured. I will mention two things that I found very interesting. In quarter horse racing, they're always mixed fields. Now, it's a much shorter, it's a quarter mile race every time, so that's different. Plus, they're not thoroughbreds, so they're not as delicate. But in Europe, apparently, many races have both males and females in them. It's only in the United States where there are so many horses for fillies only that many owners think it just makes more sense financially to keep in that category.
And I think it's interesting that her first owner refused to let her compete against male horses. Do you think how much of that was just sort of a money thing? Because if you have a good filly, you can race her in other races and just make a lot more money that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a simple storyline to say, oh, that owner, you know, was so mean. He didn't want Rachel to see her full potential. But the fact is, and one of the
things— It's a business decision.
It's a business decision.
Right.
Also, Dolph Morrison, who died last fall, was her original breeder and owner. And he was a small time guy. He had a handful of horses. He loved to do it, but it was a hobby. He didn't have millions of dollars at his disposal. Now, Jess Jackson, who bought Rachel after that, has millions of dollars.
Well, he paid $10 million for her, which is kind of crazy to think he paid $10 million for this horse.
It was unheard of, an unheard of number for a filly. People pay that much sometimes for male horses, but never for a filly, and not to race her.
And to remind Jackson, this is Kendall Jackson, the winery owner. That's where his money came from also. This is sort of another business he has, which is horse racing.
That's right. That's right.
And he was the one who just said, you know what, let's just try it and see what happens.
Yes, that's right. So it's easy to think, oh, you know, big bad millionaire.
I spent $10 million on this horse.
Right,
but let's
I know.
Just see.
But on the other hand, it's kind of cool to think about what kind of personality is willing to get a filly at that cost and still just run her, you know, just see what she could do. Now, granted, he also owned Curlin, who was the horse of the year the previous year, 2008, and he did breed them. So, you know, there was an added motivation, but he was ready to let her run as long as she enjoyed running.
Deb, what did you learn most about the world of horse racing that you wanted to convey in this book?
Well, I want to just say first that the main story that I wanted to tell was a girl power story, flat out. Some of the things that I learned along the way about the world don't actually really fit in a middle grade book. There are things about, like, some of those financial considerations, you know, some of the egos that are involved, all these kinds of interesting things about that world that don't fit in a middle grade
book.
Right,
not really appropriate for that age group, too.
No.
Sure.
Yeah.
So does it make you want to write another book about her?
Not really. I will say that, again, the people I met were lovely. But that was a very small corner of the racing world, and it's pretty insular. I think it would be pretty hard to write that other story.
So I was thinking about this book. I was thinking that one of my nieces would love this. She's 11. I think it's just the perfect book for her. But you made a really interesting comment to me. This is a girl power book that you want boys to read also.
Yes. I know that, and it was in the back of my mind from the very beginning, that you know, that many girls go through a horse crazy stage. And I definitely wrote this story with them in mind. But I feel like I want everybody to read this book. I feel like it's a great story of an underdog. It's a story about a little horse who was abandoned by her mom, who was knock-kneed and scruffy, and she turned into this amazing athlete. And I think that's a great story for boys, too. I made the point recently to somebody else that if the men and the boys in our life can't cheer for the females in their life, then, you know, we're not in good shape. So, yes, I would encourage anyone with a nephew or a niece or a grandchild of any gender to give them this book.
And if for you, it's a story of girl power, but it also sounds like it's a story of perseverance.
Yes, it is. It's definitely a story of perseverance. And it's a story, I don't know, of just flat out athleticism. I mean, she is a big horse with a glossy coat and big muscles. There's another famous filly, Ruffian, who was very, very, very fast, but she had these skinny little stick legs, and she didn't make it. She broke down on the track.
Mm. This is the story of Rachel Alexandra, also known as Alexandra the Great. That's the title of this book. It's called Alexandra the Great, the story of the record-breaking filly who ruled the racetrack. It's a new book out by the Urbana-based writer Deb Aronson. Deb, thanks so much for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. I enjoyed it.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, is all at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.